Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to answer your questions. You know, there's a huge asteroid, four times the size of the Empire State Building, barreling toward Earth. But I think we'll live. We'll talk about that and many other things, including a possible meteor storm and various nuts and bolts. We'll tell you all about it. Give us a call if you have an astronomy question. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551 with your astronomy questions. Or email voxpop@wamc.org. Astronomers Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson and you and me right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers, double the fun today in Studio A as we talk about the final frontier. We have Bob Berman, who is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. He's written a dozen or more books. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Her semester at Oneonta is done. She looks very relaxed. It's great to have these two back in the studio. You got an astronomy question? Give us a call. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Again, that number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, another semester has come to a close.
It has. It was a lot of fun. My big astronomy class, they all did very well. We got to go to the planetarium a whole bunch. It was so nice to have them back in person, let me tell you. That makes a world of a difference.
And you got through it. This was a big one for everybody, students and teachers alike. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on that. Enjoy your summer. Bob Berman, how you doing?
Good. Everything's good.
Yeah, really? Yeah. That's all you got? No, you brought a huge piece of metal. What is that?
It's cool.
Well, since this isn't TV, it was just for you guys to
see. People can watch online.
It's a major nut from the Large Hadron Collider.
Yes.
At CERN. This is part of the equipment that discovered the Higgs boson.
It's quite a, don't they need this for the collider? What, did you take it off the thing?
I hope and assume they have a few extra nuts just in case they need things extra tight.
Any number of hilarious jokes there. But anyway, go ahead. That's great. That is, that's big.
Well, yeah, thank you for introducing me. And of course, I wouldn't bring that to a radio show.
You brought meteorites. Why not bring a nut from the Hadron Collider?
Good.
Well, it's,
point.
And you know, Bob, you have been, you're not in the league of some astronomers who really poo-poo lunar eclipses, but you've not been all that effusive about them. You said this was a goodie.
It was a goodie, and the only reason is that the last few years we've had penumbral eclipses in 2020 and 2021. Every single lunar eclipse was penumbral, which means the full moon failed to go into Earth's main dark umbral shadow, missed it, and only went into our outer shadow, which is so wimpy that most people, including myself, can't even tell that an eclipse is going on. So should I advise our readers of Astronomy Magazine or the Old Farmer's Almanac to actually go out, look up, or drive to a place where they can see it when the full moon doesn't change at all? No. But this time, if you got clearer weather, that was pretty cool. This was a nice full total lunar eclipse. And even though nothing happens during a lunar totality the way it does in a solar totality, when like all sorts of things happen that make people weep with emotion, nonetheless, the moon turned a nice deep red. It was uneven in color. I thought it was lovely.
Mm-hmm. Val, did you see it?
I did, and we didn't think we were going to. You know, originally we had plans to have a big event down at Oneonta, but we canceled it because it was storming all day. But I got to watch it from my sunroom out front. I watched the first half, and then I decided to go to bed because I've seen them before. But yeah. I watched it at least until totality happened.
Well, that's great. You know, I forgot, basically, but my daughter, who was at college, saw it and was quite impressed. So that's nice.
Excellent.
I mentioned at the top of the show, a huge asteroid is heading our way May 27th. Are we going to be okay?
Yeah, I think we're going to be fine.
How far away? I love these headlines. This was from space.com. Asteroid four times the size of the Empire State Building barreling toward Earth on May 27th.
They got to get you to click on the link. Well, that's the thing.
And then the smaller type, the asteroid will zoom safely past at 47,000 miles per hour. How far away will this thing be?
Oh, about 10 times the Earth-Moon distance, so plenty far away.
That is clickbait. That's not fair at all.
It's true. It's true.
Anything else going on in the world of astronomy before I
phones? So. The word meteor and meteor shower, we were just talking about this. You know, when you say meteor shower, that could be one of the two dozen minor showers that happen every year where instead of the normal background rate, which, by the way, is 6 meteors an hour between midnight and dawn any night.
Really?
If you're away from the lights of town.
Okay.
If you're in bright city lights, you're not going to see that. But if you're in the country, between midnight and dawn, you'll typically see one every 10 minutes on average. Well, a minor meteor shower could double that so that you'll see now an extra meteor every 10 minutes or so, or maybe even two extra meteors. Mm-hmm. Is that worth getting up for if it's at 3 a.m. or 2 a.m.? I don't know. I think it's sort of on the edge of whether it's worth getting up for. But we also have two or three major meteor showers. Now, here is a meteor a minute. Everyone knows about the summer Perseids every August 11th. Mm-hmm. Just as good, in some years even better, are the Geminids every December 13th. Again, one a minute. So those are definitely worth staying up for. Any way to get even better than that? Well, yes, every once in a while there'll be a stray, if you're looking at the sky, fireball, which is defined as a meteor brighter than the planet Venus, which means bright enough to cast shadows, or a bolide, which means an exploding meteor, one that looks like sparks or looks like a firework.
Yeah.
So can you even get better than that?
Yes.
One thing only, and that's a meteor storm.
Ooh.
The most famous was in 1833 when there were about 50 meteors per second. That's not a misprint. That's not a typo. 50 shooting stars a second.
When was this?
1833.
And how was that?
many people who were out at the time, I'm being edited here from giving more details, but thought that it was a sign from heaven of changes to come, which happened a little later that century. And the song, The Stars Fell on Alabama, inspired by that. And we had a repeat in 1866. And so, hey, that looks like a 33-year periodicity. And sure enough, there is a particular comet called Temple Tuttle that repeats at that interval. So it looked like maybe it'll happen again in 1899. It didn't. What about 1933? It didn't. Everyone assumed, well, that's the end of that.
Yeah.
A giant planet like Jupiter perturbed the debris. It's not going to hit us anymore. So it was a surprise when on November 18th, 1966, it again happened. And we're talking about dozens of meteors per second, all radiating away from the constellation of Leo the Lion, near the famous double star Algeba. And I was pleased. Two of my former students, back when I taught astronomy, two people had seen it. One was he had been on guard duty in the service at the time. The other was a woman on a train. I still remember her name, Victoria Drowns. Very unusual name.
Yes.
This has sticks in my mind. She said she was on a train. It was about 3 a.m. in the southwest. That's where it could be seen. She's looking out the window. Can we imagine dozens of meteors a second coming from one spot in the sky as if someone had drilled a hole through the firmament and sparks are leaking in from another dimension? I can't imagine that. She looked around the compartment, she told me, and everyone else in her compartment was asleep. And she said she really wondered, what's the protocol? What's the etiquette for this when it's the end of the world? Which she was sure it has to be the end of the world. Right. Are you supposed to wake people up for it or let them sleep through it? I mean, these were strangers.
Well, it's a great question.
What are you supposed to do? Anyway, then the conductor came by and she called him over, and together the two of them watched this spectacle until dawn erased the show. That was in 66. The closest we've come to a storm since then happened in the early morning hours of November 18th to 19th in 2001, just a few months after the unfortunate 9/11 tragedies. And at that time, the Northeast, our region had clear skies, moonless skies, and we had not several a second, but we did have one a minute. They were all green. They were all brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all left behind lingering trains, they're called. Some would call them trails of lingering, glowing debris.
Cool.
And that was certainly the best meteor shower I've ever seen. I was happy that I alerted my readers in Astronomy Magazine and other places, and here on public radio. So that was the last real storm. Well, we have a chance. That there's a chance. It's not likely, but a chance is well worth going out and checking out.
When is the chance?
Midnight on the night of May 30th to 31st.
So Monday into Tuesday.
Yes. On midnight that night, if it's clear, definitely go out and just look up. You'll know right away during that 1 hour. Just check it out, mm-hmm. whether it's happening or not. And if it's happening, you don't want to miss it.
And they were green because they were predominantly copper? I mean, why are they green?
Yes. Isn't that something? See, he knows these things. See, my wife.
Why are you surprised?
He's been interviewing you for a long time. He's heard these stories.
I don't know if I've ever heard the story about Madame Drowns or whatever, but hey, you know what? Let's take a break. Let's take a pause in the reminiscences. We'll be back. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is with us, and also Valerie Rapson. Valerie Rapson, how is the ticket to TV stardom coming along?
It's going really good. I've been working on my series for The Great Courses about, you know, how you take pictures with your telescope and actually do real science with them. So I'm actively writing, and I'm excited this summer. I have a bunch of students that are going to stay and work with me, and we're going to take some images with the telescope at Oneonta and hopefully use some of them during the series as, you know, proof of concept that I can do it, my students can do it, and that means you can do it too if you have similar equipment.
That is so cool. So we'll get updates on that over the months ahead.
For sure.
Let's go to the phones, 800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question for Bob and Valerie. Steve in Gansvoort. Steve.
Wow, number one for the day.
Yeah.
That's the first.
All right, well, go ahead. Make it a good one. That's all. Make it good.
Well, I posed a question to my son, who's an astronomical engineer out in California, and he kind of shrugged his shoulders. So maybe you can, maybe you can't.
Okay.
I understand the idea of satellites orbiting the Earth and in different orbital patterns. But when I think about the Webb telescope out at one of the Lagrange points, and I imagine it as being a location, if you just ran a string perpendicular to the Earth to that point, there sits the Webb. And yet it's orbiting in a fashion that would be similar to a Frisbee spinning around a stick. It's orbiting not in a line with the pole from the Earth to the L2 point, but perpendicular to that. Yet there's nothing there for it to orbit. There's no celestial body. There's no point of gravity. How do you get something to orbit nothing?
Val.
Yeah, well, it is sort of a gravitational balance point. There are many Lagrange points that kind of balance between the Earth and the Sun, the Earth and the outer planets. And this is, L2 is kind of we call it a potential well, basically, where there is no object there producing a gravitational pull, but there is a spot where things can be placed in a small orbit of their own in that stable gravitational position. And then Webb will follow the Earth around in its orbit, moving at exactly the right speed to stay in that position. So you don't really need a physical object there to produce the gravity. It's a combination of the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon, and all the planets in the solar system that kind of make this point a position of stability in the orbit.
Can you predict that mathematically?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So
that's
how
they
gravity
knew.
Well? Is that what they call that?
Yeah, sort of. It's one way to think about it.
That's really interesting, Steve.
And my understanding is that it's not a stable orbit. It has to be course corrected very regularly.
Yes, yes, it does.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Steve, thanks a lot. Bob, you want to add anything to that?
No, I like that. I like the whole thing.
All right, fair enough. That's one check mark for us. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. Our buddy Merle and Argyle. Merle, go ahead.
Hey, I'm on. Hi, boys and girls.
Hello.
The question I have is magnetic field on the moon.
Ah.
I understood there wasn't one, but Stardate that comes on NPR, they were talking about a lunar lander that's going to investigate a magnetic field, and they were showing it on the...
Oh, Merle, you're killing me. All right.
It's on one of the planes of the moon, and the lander is going there to investigate. Do you know anything about it?
Anybody? Bob?
Well, we've got celestial objects with global gravitational fields, like, fortunately, Earth. Jupiter has a big one. Oh, I love Jupiter's because it manages to hold on to some of the debris that Io gives off with its volcanoes, and then it ionizes it because of the sunlight hitting it, and so you get these radioactive zones, a lot of energy and stuff happening there. But you also have bodies, like the moon is one of them, and Mercury is another, that do not have or have such weak global gravitational fields. But many of them do have little pockets because they've been hit by things that have had enough metallic materials or magnetic materials within them, asteroids in the past. There's a whole body called octahedrites that can do that. And so you can get local gravitational fields, just like Earth has some local areas, but there's no global gravitational field. So the solar system is a potpourri of objects within
Merle was talking about magnetic field.
Magnetic fields. Did I say gravitational? Yeah. I'm misspeaking myself. That's magnetic fields because of mostly we think it happens just the way it happened with us, that you have a mostly iron or nickel iron liquid core and you're rotating and you're setting up a dynamo. You're just setting up a situation for a global magnetic field then. But if too much time passes, as happened on Mars, Mars is only 1/2 hour diameter, and so it cooled down. And so you no longer have that liquid metal, and you lose your global magnetic field.
All right. So the upshot is the moon, thanks, Merle, does or does not have a magnetic field?
It does not, as far as we know, or it is extremely weak. And that's what we're trying to figure out with these satellites is it there in very small concentrations, as Bob was saying, in localized places?
Yeah.
Or what is the strength? And sometimes we can even collect rocks and study them in depth in a lab. To find the history of the magnetic field on different planets, including our own.
The moon seems still to be mysterious. It has almost like a bell-like quality when you bang satellites or junk into it.
It's true.
It's a hollow spaceship, isn't it, Bob?
Well, it may be a little bit crystal in its center, but all of this is keys to how it was formed. And since an object that we actually have named Theia collided with Earth, apparently, a Mars-sized object, and the result was an amalgam of Earth material and Theia material, but it didn't go to the core of Earth, so it really took mantle material from the Earth, so we shouldn't be surprised that we didn't get any of this heavy-duty nickel iron stuff that you'd want to have in your core if you want to have a global magnetic field.
So, yeah.
So the moon's lack of a magnetic field actually makes sense.
Okay, fair enough. The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. It's Astronomy with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman. This email from Joel. Subject heading white holes. Black holes, especially the one at the center of the Milky Way, have been in the news lately. But is there any evidence for the existence of white holes?
Not yet. We keep looking, but,
well,
you know.
What are they supposed to be, Valerie?
Yeah, well, they would be. So there's the theory that if material falls into a black hole, it may not just turn to energy and stay there the rest of its life. It would pop out somewhere else in the universe. And this would require black holes to act like wormholes. And, you know, physics would be different than we think it is. But if we observed, you know, locations where mysterious material seem to pop out or flash or do something, then that could be evidence of a white hole. But we have never seen that. You know, any new flash of light could be attributed to a nova, a supernova, something like that. So far, no white holes
right.
exist.
It actually has origin from a paper by Albert Einstein and Nathan Rosen. And for a while, this was called a Einstein-Rosen bridge.
Ah, yes.
And that was supposedly because on paper, mathematically, if you had the absolute warping of space-time that a black hole does create, you could have essentially a tunnel through space or time where there'd be an emerging of energy in another place or another time. This really gets really weird. But further studies have shown that even a person's mass would be enough to collapse it and make it not stable and not happen. And so forget about all the sci-fi thoughts of traveling through one and then emerging along with a lot of light in a different time of the universe.
Why forget about that?
Well, because you don't want to celebrate your granddad's birthday.
Sure, there's folk songs about that. I'm my own grandpa. yeah, buddy. All right, let's see. Back to the phones. And Pat in Albany. Pat, you're on. Hi, Pat. You're overwhelmed, I can tell. Go ahead, you're on.
Hi, Bob. This is Pat, and I think I called in maybe 25 years ago and talked about this with you.
Wow. Well, let's do it again.
I was in Wyoming as a passenger in a car driving up north along Jackson Lake, and I witnessed a daytime fireball.
Oh, I'm envious.
And the photo of the almost the exact location I was at made the cover of like Sky and Telescope or one of those with the fireball streaking over the Tetons.
Did it seem to be moving more horizontally or vertically through the sky?
Horizontally.
Right. I knew you would say that. That seems to always be the case for some reason. Yes.
Well, yeah, it was a beautiful day, almost like today here in Albany with blue skies and puffy cumulus clouds. And I happened to be looking out at the Tetons, and I noticed the streak. It looked like a commercial jet, but then I thought it was a missile because it was glowing like an arc welder at its lead, at its head. And then it made, I thought, like puffs. So I thought, oh my goodness, this thing is crashing. And watched it go across the sky. We had time to pull the car over the shoulder. Three of us get out. It must have been 20, 30 seconds for it to go out of sight over the horizon to the north.
Ah, you're a lucky man. Any color with it?
No, not. It was a white, like, contrail, I guess you'd say. But it would flash in light intensity, brighten, dim a bit, brighten. So to me, it looked like something crashing.
Amazing.
Yeah. You're a lucky person.
Very cool. Well, Pat, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. And to Glens Falls we go. Mike, you're on.
Hi, thank you very much. A couple of weeks ago, there was a story about a plant or some plants being grown in moon soil. And, of course, the story was kind of raving all about it. I'm a little skeptical. Would that be possible if the plant was on the moon using the moon's environment. I'm skeptical about it growing in the moon's environment.
Nah, it wouldn't, because regolith, which is our name for the very talcum powdery soft lunar soil, is essentially the same stuff as beach sand. It's really silicon dioxide. So if you think of silica, commonly called, it's a type of quartz. It's not very nourishing for anything. There's no water in there. There's no moisture, zero. There's no organic material, and by that we mean carbon. And it's hard to imagine any plant liking the lunar regolith and anything sprouting from that, even if you kept watering it.
Well, it did sprout, though.
You saw that story?
Yeah.
Well, it sprouted here on Earth.
Yeah, not on the moon.
Using the Earth's environment.
I see.
That's what I'm asking.
And what did they have to add to it?
They were stunted. And I forget what plants they were. Valerie, do you remember?
I saw the headline, but I didn't see the details of it. But I would imagine, as Bob was saying, they would have had to add, at the very least, a lot of water, if not some other sort of artificial fertilizer. My guess is that if you were going to use this on the moon, you would have to build some sort of biodome and pressurize it and make it as close to Earth as possible.
So bring some Miracle-Gro or something.
Yeah, something like that. And again, I didn't see all the details, but it's interesting.
I'm right to be skeptical.
Yeah,
then.
I'm still skeptical too.
Right, right. Or do the stuff they did in that film, The Martian, that is I guess I'm not going to be any more graphic than
Let's
that.
Let's not Never go mind. There.
We won't.
All right.
Go
you know what? Thanks, Mike, for the call, and thanks, Bob, for just a little bit of decorum here. And we go to Fred and Wine and Skill. Fred, you're on.
Hi. So when planets form and it's molten, the heavier elements, they kind of go to the center, like iron and nickel and that sort of thing. So these asteroids that have high concentrations of iron and nickel and stuff, does that speak to that they want that concentration of iron and such was caused by a planet that formed and then basically broke apart?
Interesting.
That was our old paradigm back when I was a kid. The one of the main ideas was a sci-fi one, that this was a planet that maybe, and there were all sorts of fanciful ideas, that the civilization got carried away, as ours sometimes does, and blew it up, or it exploded, and that's what we're seeing, is the debris. But current thinking for a long time is that no, there never was an entire whole planet there that blew up. It was actually a planet that failed to form, right, Valerie?
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, the caller was exactly right, talking about differentiation. That's the scientific term for it. But the heavier material, when you have a molten pile of material, the more dense stuff will sink to the bottom. So these are just pieces of material that got warm enough and ended up differentiating. So we see the heavy metals, they were the core. Now, the smaller asteroids may have broken apart a little. They may have lost some mantle-like material, but they definitely weren't entire planets that did this.
Let's take a quick break. It's Astronomy Today. Valerie Rapson is with us from SUNY Oneonta, and Bob Berman from our own program, Mysterious, what's it called? Strange Universe. Right. It's on very early on the weekends. I've listened to it a few times. I've seen you record it more than I've listened to it. Is it worth it?
Is it worth? I don't know.
All right, let's take a break. Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy with Valerie Rapson from SUNY Oneonta and Bob Berman. Hey, Bob, by the way, there is all the talk about space tourism. Do you think that Bob Berman, and you got the tour company, whatever the company's name is.
Special Interest
right.
Tours.
Do you ever think you'll do that someday? You bring the folks up to the...
Ooh,
you'll really get a view, huh?
I love this guy. Yes, yeah, we shall go every year to the Northern Lights, to our secret places, and every year there's a total solar eclipse, which is almost every year. We'll go to the clearest place that we anticipate we can go to. And yeah, people can just find it. Actually, if they just type in my name and the word tour, Bob Berman Tour, it'll take you to the company.
But what I want to know right now is, will special interest tours ever take people to the moon?
Well, why don't we go online and just see?
You know what, Bob? That's not helpful. This email from Sherry. I've seen it documented that seismographic readings after an object was crashed into the moon indicated the moon is hollow. Is it true or another dubious story, Valerie?
Oh, I don't think it's completely hollow, but those earthquakes, whether they are natural to the moon, and I called them earthquakes, I should really call them moonquakes,
yeah.
But whether they're natural occurrences on the moon or something striking the moon to cause them, they do allow us to learn about the different layers and the different interiors. It could be, you know, lower density or more crystalline on the inside than the Earth, but I don't think it's completely hollow. I think we're past that.
No, it's not hollow, but it was really striking, no pun intended, that unneeded parts of our spacecraft during the Apollo era that were left crashing to the lunar surface.
Yeah.
For example, we didn't need the ascent stage anymore once we got up from the surface, sent it crashing to the moon. And the moon, as I think you brought up earlier,
rang
Ray,
like a bell.
Would ring for up to 2 or 2.5 hours, or maybe it was 1.5 hours or something like that. But it would continue to vibrate as if it were a bell being struck, which shows that the interior certainly is different from our liquidy interior. Probably is, you used the word crystalline, something like a crystalline interior that's very different from ours.
There seems to be this race to go back to the moon. I'm sure there are some military or commercial aspects to all this, but every country with the capability of firing rockets seems to want to go and bring people back to the moon. And one of the things they have talked about in the past as possible shelters for astronauts are these lava tubes. I guess there are some huge lava tubes throughout. Have they done any sonographic mapping or anything with these? Is there any way that you could map them from the surface? Ground-penetrating radar?
Maybe. Not that I have seen, but, I mean, as technology improves, depending on how deep they are and how thick the crust is, right, you might be able to get a little bit of a sense. Or, you know, nowadays we're flying drones on Mars, and we could just send a drone to the moon and go investigate it. So we probably could in the future figure it out.
Yeah, and the real bottom line is you're escaping from radiation.
Yeah.
We mentioned earlier that our magnetic field, our magnetosphere, blocks radiation. What happens when the poles flip, which they do on average 3 times every million years?
Yeah.
Well, it turns out just our atmosphere provides as much shielding as 13 feet of concrete.
Mm.
It provides as much shielding as the entire magnetosphere. So we could lose our magnetic field entirely and still be shielded thanks to our thick atmosphere. The moon has neither. It doesn't have a global magnetic field, and it doesn't have an atmosphere. And that's why Ray's saying, well, then how are you going to not be getting lots of chest x-rays worth of radiation every single day there? And that's one way, if you can get underground.
All right. It seems kind of pointless. If you have to stay underground, why go to the moon? But that's another question. Here's a question from Aaron in Greenfield, and then we'll go back to the phones. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question for Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. Aaron in Greenfield writes, there have been a couple times on this show that you've mentioned the evidence of Martian microbial life being discovered in Antarctica, if I'm not mistaken. Can you explain this? That was sort of debunked, right?
It was ALH84001. That was the meteorite found in Antarctica. And Dan Golden, back when he was head of NASA in, I believe it was 1986, made an announcement surrounded by experts that they found in this meteorite that had landed 16,000 years ago in Antarctica, little curlicue things that looked like they were fossilized bacteria. Mm. You know, bacteria look like curlicues.
Yeah.
And they thought that they were actually finding real evidence of life on Mars, or at least fossilized life on Mars. And you didn't hear about it too much. For some reason, it didn't make all of the national news shows. Hey, life
sure
on Mars,
you
had found. And these days, most scientists, not all, but most think that it looked like bacteria, fossilized stuff, but it was probably something else that nobody knows for sure. It's just some weird stuff. But yes, the caller is right. Martian meteorite. Unforgettable name, ALH84001.
Maybe all for right. you.
Fair enough. It's Astronomy Today, 800-348-2551. We'll go back to the phones. Tom and Gardner. Tom, you're on.
Hello. I would just like to share a really interesting sighting I had, and I'll let you guys explain to everyone
okay.
what was going on. I was looking up in the sky about 10 years ago during the August meteor shower time. It was in the early evening. I'm looking towards the east, and about 30 degrees above the horizon, I see a light, a pinpoint of light, orange, yellowish orange, and it's moving, apparently to the south, but I have no idea which way it was really going. And I would say it went in a straight line through about 60 degrees of a sweep of my arm. And it's about 30 degrees above the horizon. As it's moving in this very steady speed, it gradually gets brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter and then dimmer and then dimmer and dimmer and dimmer. And well, by golly, I knew what it was. It was an Earth-grazing asteroid.
Okay.
But 3 days later, I'm looking in the same spot at approximately the same time, and I see the same, leave out the adjective, thing.
Thank you.
Only this time, the glowing object is a little bit larger, and as it goes by in the same spot at the same speed, I see a black center. And I say, by golly, it's closer. I want to be here in a couple of days. I want to see where it hits.
Yeah.
Well, that's my story. And the reason I'm sharing it is because I want everyone to just look at the skies when they can, because there's fantastic stuff up there that you don't need anything for except a set of eyes.
I think that's a great point, Tom. Astronomers, what do you say?
Thank you.
Well, it sounds awfully terrestrial as opposed to extraterrestrial, especially when things, you know, move relatively slowly in straight lines and make angles. You know, it's definitely something here on Earth. You know, exactly what it is, could be a balloon, could be a helicopter in the distance, you know, early drones. It's hard to tell exactly what it is, but it doesn't sound like, you know, you spotted Venus and mistook it for a spot
or
something.
It does sound terrestrial. Yeah, we astronomers tend to be skeptics because we tend not to see them. I had the second thing on top of being an astronomer all my life. I was also a pilot. I only sold my plane a couple of years ago, and I've had thousands of hours of flying at night here in the Hudson Valley region, and I have never seen anything that was that couldn't be explainable. So I'm not saying that proves anything, but I'm from Missouri.
Yeah.
So,
are you really?
Yeah.
So
I'd like to see a genuine UFO for myself, and then I'll
did I miss that? Was Tom saying it was a UFO?
No, yeah. I thought that was a very rational report. He was reporting what he saw and saying it was strange, and it's one more reason to watch the sky.
And I think that's the upshot. Look at the sky. There's a lot of great stuff to see. Even if we're not astronomers, there are wonderful things. In fact, they're even more wonderful for people like me. Because I don't know what it is. I say, oh, what is that? Oh, that's the moon. Bill in Albany. Bill, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm just wondering, what would it take to do long-term space travel and create artificial gravity? Like you see in 2001, it's my understanding you have a rotating sphere like they did. And it would alleviate, they say, some of the health issues affecting eyes, heart, cells, reversing, from what I understand.
Yeah, it would be very tricky, you know, because you have to the basic technology is you have to get something spinning to create that artificial gravity, which takes a lot of energy to do that. And once you get something spinning in space, you know, it will continue to spin forever. But there will still be some drag, and you're still going to have to make corrections. So could we make something with artificial gravity that's small and temporary? Yeah, I could see that in the near future. But, you know, long term, many generations heading to the next star, I think it'd be a lot more difficult.
The easiest way would be
to get hold of... Is there any substitute for it?
Yeah, here's a substitute. All you have to do is get hold of some crab pulsar material, some neutron star material. You wouldn't even need much. I would say probably one refrigerator's volume worth of that material would give you all the gravity, and you just put that in the essential basement of your spacecraft, and you'll have all the gravity you'll ever want.
Yeah, but you got to get there first to get this material.
Yeah, 6,500 light years away. It's a bit of a challenge.
Bill, thanks for the call very much. So what is the physics behind this business? And we've seen it in movies since the 50s and 60s where you have a rotating space station. What is the physics that makes it simulate gravity? In other words, a spinning object.
You've been on carnival rides. You've experienced it yourself, haven't you? Where you've been stuck to the wall?
Not in a while. Yes, I know the one you're talking about. And it didn't end well.
Yeah, I bet
all
not.
All my children have
I
been on
not.
It.
I bet not.
So,
no, it's just rotational forces. Yeah, exactly. When you have a rotating object, you have forces inward and outward. And if you spin it at just the right rate, you can get essentially a force inwards that can mimic gravity. You just have to do it right.
Is that being done on Earth?
Well,
we spin.
It's really just inertia in that case, because object moving wants to stay in a straight line. But if you're on a carnival ride that's curving, it's stopping you from going in a straight line. And the preventing you from going in a straight line is what makes you stick to the wall, really. Mm-hmm. So it's actually pretty simple.
All right. Don't buy that. Bob Berman at Valerie Rapson join us today. It's Astronomy on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551. The number, email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Valerie, what's the latest on the James Webb Telescope?
Last I saw, mirrors were aligned. They're working on commissioning of the science instruments, and we are expecting the first image sometime in mid-July. And they should give us like an actual date ahead of time so that we can prepare for a day-long press release.
But it'll be exciting, though.
It's going to be amazing. And there's, a lot of places are getting excited. A lot of local museums are hosting events, so it's going to be a fun day. But everything is going smoothly and looking forward to it.
I'll bet they don't use M100 as their first image.
It's bad luck.
Yeah.
All right, Bob. Let's go to Rob in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on.
Hi, I have yet another meteor shower story.
Ah.
So I didn't even know that we had that meteor shower in December until I was walking my dog at 4 in the morning. And there was shooting star after shooting star, and I was at a softball field. And within less than 5 minutes apart, two of them came so close that they burned up maybe 20 feet from the ground. They just got a little streak, and the tail got finer and finer and shorter, and about 20 feet from the ground, it looked like somebody lit a whole pack of matches on fire.
Now, many regard those showers.
I was out there with my dog.
Many regard those as the year's best, the Geminid shower on December 13th, that they exceed the Perseids on more years than they don't. And that's our future, too, because meteor showers, because they're meteoroids, these are tiny things smaller than apple seeds on average, and they're moving inward closer to the sun. There's something called the pointing Robertson effect, where sunlight itself exerts a drag on the meteoroidal material, and so the effect is that it moves inward. Well, the Perseid meteors that have been here for thousands of years have already gotten to our orbit and are soon, on a cosmic scale, in a few hundred years, going to be a little bit too close to the sun, closer in than we are, and will start disappointing us a little bit. But the Geminids are still on the outer reaches of hitting Earth. So the future is that December 13th Geminid shower that you saw. So keep looking at it, because that's where our kids and grandkids best meteor showers will lie.
Tom followed up. Tom from Gardner, who talked about the meteor that he saw twice. And he said, I was misunderstood in my call. I was suggesting that I saw the same Earth-grazing meteor twice and was darned lucky for it.
Oh.
That's not possible in the course of days, is
no,
it?
No, no, no. I didn't pick that up from that. And it also doesn't make sense because for a meteor to be seen in the sky, I mean, the definition of meteor as opposed to a meteoroid, which is invisible, that's just the chunk of rock, or a meteorite, which is when it's finished its journey and it's just a piece of debris lying on the ground that you pick up. An actual meteor is a meteor because it's burning up through the atmosphere, and the act of burning up is only a very limited range. It starts up a little closer to us than 100 miles, finishes up at about 35, 40 miles. Lower than that, it's not even going to glow anymore. And in all this process, it's slowing down. That's why a meteor that actually hits your roof, which, by the way, happens about once every year and a quarter to some house in North America, typically only hits at 300 miles an hour, whereas they start out closer to 20 miles a second, typically, end up slow because of the passage through the atmosphere. So this caller's report of the meteor that to see it, it meant it was burning up, which means it was slowing down. No, it's not going to be around the next day to continue its orbit and be seen in the same spot. I don't see any way that can happen. What do you think, Valerie?
No, I agree. And I do want to share one quick cool thing I learned the other day. There are dogs that you can train to find meteorites.
What?
Is that really
true? Somebody told me and I looked it up and I found the articles. I don't fully understand, you know, what they're sniffing out, but you can train the dogs to go on meteorite hunts with you, and I've decided I now need a dog so that I can train it.
Is it a specific breed?
No, I think they just, you know, have to be those good types of tracking dogs, and there must be, like, you know, outgassing or some sort of chemical reaction between the metallic meteorite and Earth that
even
they
can sniff
out.
Even when it's on the ground and cool and just sitting.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be fresh from my understanding, so.
And you've got to have patience. There have been exactly 13 meteorites found in New York State during our state's entire history.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not everywhere. They're not commonly found. So you're going to have to take this dog on walks.
I'm committed for a thousand years. I'm committed.
All right. We have time. We only have 1 minute left here, and we'll just very quickly go to Ben in New Paltz. Ben, you only have about 30 seconds. Go.
Okay. I know what a drone looks like in the sky. I was on Route 32 going north between Saugerties and Catskill. The drone then, what I thought was a drone, flipped its belly side up, and there were three really large white lights underneath it. It then proceeded to make a beeline on that same trajectory and disappeared.
Cool. Well, that's a good way to end the show. And Bob is a skeptic, you know, Ben. So, Bob, go ahead. You got 10 seconds.
Well, I'll just say that a friend of mine and I stargazing once in the darkest part of the Catskills heard a roar over our heads, and there was an object very low with green and red lights, and it was obviously some kind of military spacecraft, but it was not lit up normally. It was doing some sort, and it was trailed by a smaller object that's smaller than a plane. So what the heck was that? We have no idea to this day. It was obviously artificial. It seemed to be military, but it was not. A celestial natural object. So you will see all odd things that are inexplainable or unexplainable.
Well, this was a kind of a low-key but fun show, right?
Yeah.
So we'll do it again?
Sure.
All right. Sounds good.
Bob
Berman, Valerie Rapson, thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Support comes from Grapes on Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 20 years, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. GrapesOnGrainsWine.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie presenting New York State Grange photographs, contemporary large format black and white images by Andrew Bonnet, arkellmuseum.org. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarriers and fabricators used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. And Capital Roots, working to provide healthy food access with dignity for all Capital Region residents while supporting area farms and businesses. Grow, educate, provide, capitalroots.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Interesting calls, interesting emails. Well done, everybody. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Plumbing with Alan Ayers. That's tomorrow at 2. Get your wrench and join us then.